Okay, thank you. It's a pleasure to being here. Thank you for the kind invitation. Okay, so the course would look like that. What I will do in the first lecture is give some overview of the most recent method that we have been working with. Just to give you a motivation of what can be done at the end of the day. And then tomorrow and the day after, I will give two more elaborate lectures on the method that we are using now. Five lectures are more than enough for a superficial course, and very short time for a deep course in which I'm trying to. So I will do probably something in the middle. So those of you who are looking for just applications, this would not be the course, and those of you who are looking for rigorous proof, this would not be the course, but rather something. I will try to do something in between. There will be at least two proofs and some tools. So what are we playing with? What my group and I have been doing in the recent years is trying to investigate what is going on with non-rigid objects. And in this case, you can see the Vitruvian Man of Da Vinci embedded first of all in a circle and then in a square, L1, L2 if you want. And we will try to follow the same idea and see what is going on. I mean, given two shapes, like these two instances of the heart in two different two different times of the cardiac cycle, how should we compare them? Is it really Da Vinci's face in the Mona Lisa? How can we measure them? How can we quantify them? What is the right metric to compare between such surfaces? So how should we compare surfaces, specifically the heart? We will get there, but let me take you through my perspective, or at least the way that I see how history evolved towards the current goal of what people are trying to do, and this is treating non-rigid shapes like the hand. So if we go to the 70s and the 80s, it was all around applying variational methods to reconstruction, first of all, and then identification of rigid objects. This is all the shape from X, shape from motion, shape from texture, shape from stereo, shape from shading. I was playing with shape from shading in the late 90s. Then came a small revolution. I think it was the Vetter and Blunt's paper that took many instances of three-dimensional shapes of the face and then were trying to reconstruct the face from a given image. And this is where non-rigidity was coming into play. First of all, from the point of view of, let's take the dimensionality into something relatively simple, and in the space of, once we find the right space in which we can do linear stuff, we are good. Then it evolved through, there was an interesting project in Stanford, Scape project. Recently I've seen a group from Switzerland who was doing facial puppetry, and this is in real time taking a three-dimensional image of your face, and there is a real-time avatar that is able to mimic what you are doing. So all these are new ways of looking at shapes, and this is the arena in which we will play. So first of all, let me just tell you some war stories about how we acquire three-dimensional shapes. So in the last 10 years, I was involved in segmenting information from medical data, for example. I will talk about active contours and active shapes and related to classical methods in image processing, like the Kenny Edge detector. There is a very nice explanation to the Kenny Edge detector from a variational point of view that I will try to show you. It has nice properties like apparently what is going on is that you are minimizing at the end of the day something which is called a Cronrod functional. And the reason that the Kenny edge detector, for example, is known to be Kenny edge detector was because Kenny gave a one-dimensional explanation to the edge detector, but now we know that if you write things properly, the explanation is, I mean, the reason that this operator is working comes from a completely different philosophy that can be explained from a variational point of view. In order to acquire 3D, we build a camera, three-dimensional sensor that you see here, a camera and a projector. The projector projects lights, pattern of lights. It hits the object, then it goes to the camera, and according to the deformation of these patterns, you can reconstruct the 3D structure of the object. If you want, I can dedicate one of the talks to that. It's interesting. Why? Because we didn't publish anything on that. We just built it. Then we let a company outside of the Technion take care of it, and it was recently sold to Intel, which is a great success. I mean, it's the first exit of the Technion after 12 years or something like that, so we are really happy with that. Why is it good for? If you have 3D objects and you can compare between them and you can create a metric for comparing between such objects, then you can do things like that. What am I showing you here? We gave our 3D scanner to a bunch of physicians, actually two of them. Israel Amirav is the leading physician there. And what they did is they went and scanned many babies between infants, newborns, and the age of three. The reason was to manufacture an inhalation mask that would fit the babies as the best way, the best there is. So, and they restricted us to only three clusters. So if you have a distance, then you can cluster, first of all the surfaces that you get into three clusters, and then take the median of each cluster, and according to that, design the new masks. So this is an old mask, and this is a new mask. This is a reconstruction of all the breathing channels that were reconstructed from a CT scan. And then they measure that indeed the masks that we are producing have better sealing and operate better when the baby is breathing. Actually, the physician that we were working with was a clever guy, so he also introduced a small hole here. Can you imagine why for? What is the reason for this small hole? In order to create better sealing for babies, what you can put is actually a pacifier here. So this is a clever physician that was able to take our know-how of how to compare between surfaces, manufacture something that is being sold today, and do something useful to humanity from that. So there is something at the end of the day. The method that I will talk about later on in this sequence of lectures would also relate to fast marching stuff. And I think in most CT and medical imaging devices now you will find some sort of active contours, active surfaces, active something in order for the physicians to be able to extract the three-dimensional structure out of this data. So there is some usefulness to that. Non-rigid objects. Talking about non-rigid objects, they can be found almost anywhere. From the point of view of science, you can think about image process, about geometric processing, biometry, computer graphics, computer vision, etc., etc. I will start by giving a motivation from biometry. Why? Because this is what our brain is occupied with all the time, and because it actually gives very interesting introduction to the to why non-rigid object matching is important. So historically, if we go back to biblical story, there is the story of Jacob and Esau, where Jacob steals the blessing from Isaac, from his father, by pretending to be somebody else, his brother, his elder brother. Then there is the famous Little Red Riding Hood, recognition by features, face recognition by features, and eventually Cinderella story, where non-rigid matching is happening in action. The prince finds his true love by matching slipper to Cinderella's leg. More recently, O.J. Simpson was acquitted because the glove that was found in the scene of the crime did not fit his hand. And the reason was because it was treated with some chemicals and then it shrank, but still, we should be able to treat such... Actually, at the end of this talk, for those of you who heard some of my previous talks, I will refer to what happens when there is a uniform shrinkage, or if there is affine transformation to the whole space, or if there is shrinkage plus, I mean... scaling plus equiaffine, which is the full affine group, we can deal with those right now for surfaces, which is something new. I cannot start this talk without mentioning two of my students who started working with me. Why? Because they also give motivation of why to match non-rigid shapes. If you look at the face of Alex and Michael and Alex Bronstein, they were sitting in one of my classes. Half of the face here belongs to Alex, the other one belongs to Michael. And then they had the assignment of taking 3D of their shape and be able to say who is whom automatically. So Alex now is a professor in Tel Aviv University. Michael is a professor in Lugano University in Switzerland. And they were able to do something. The second book that I so-called wrote was actually written by these two twins. I was just supervising at the time, so this is why it is much better than the first one. So if we drift slowly from fairy tales into science, and specifically to metric geometry, let us first of all zoom in into the face recognition problem and take a face. So given a face, an image of a face, what you would like to do is automatically say that this picture of the face belongs to one of these new instances of the same person rather than somebody different. I mean, make a robust way of separating one face from the rest of the faces out there. And the question is how to do that. So we would like to be invariant to lighting conditions, to poses of the face in 3D, orientation, translation, obviously, expressions, makeup, etc., etc. So if we analyze the problem scientifically, we can decompose the face to photometry, which is the way that the face reflects the light, and geometry, which is the structure of the face in 3D. And we will deal, although the human brain is tuned to analyze this part of the problem, we will focus on that part. Why? Because we believe that it is more interesting, and I will show you why. So then what is invariant under expressions? I mean, say that you have a perfect way of matching two faces rigidly. Would it be enough to for comparing between faces? The answer is obviously no. Why? Because think about the hand, okay? Think about two hands, my hand and your hand, for example. And if I would like to match the two hands, then rigidly comparing them, assuming that they are at the same pose, would probably work. But if I embed my hand differently in 3D space, then comparison would be useless, because comparing this hand to this hand rigidly, I mean, correcting for translation and rotation would not be, I mean, we would lose something along the way. So we painted Alex's face with points, and we embedded the face differently in 3D space. So here he makes an expression. And we asked the question, what is invariant under all these expressions? And the answer is that obviously, if you measure Euclidean distances between the points, i.e. distances in the embedding space, they will break apart. I mean, distances are not preserved very well as you, for example, embed your hand differently in 3D space. What is preserved is geodesic distances. I mean, not perfectly, but much better than Euclidean one. So if you measure distances on the surface itself, then it would be preserved, and you can count on it in order to do your comparison between surfaces. I promise you that by the end of this talk, I will show you that these kind of distances are good for one thing, but if you would like to use, for example, other scenarios in which you introduce certain amount of noise to the game, then geodesic distances are one choice, but there are better choices than that. I mean, there are ways to wrap the geodesic distances in a different way. The reason, just to give you an intuition, the reason is that if you think about the shortest path between two points, then it's really sensitive to many kind of, for example, shortening. If I'm touching the hand with, if I'm touching with these two fingers, then distances would shorten. If I take an average of distances, and it will slowly drift into what is known as diffusion geometry today, then it would be a more robust way of computing distances. I will talk about it later. If I accumulate the change in geodesic distances and Euclidean distances across many expressions, then you can see that geodesic distances are relatively tight. I mean, if they would not have changed completely, then there would be a delta function here. Nothing changes. I mean, if you take a sheet of paper and you measure the deformation, the extension of distances between points as you fold the paper differently in 3D space, then you will see a lot of change here. You will see a delta function here. The face is a little bit more elastic, if you want. So there is a little bit of geodesic distances that change, but not much. So we say that the extrinsic distances, the extrinsic geometry, is what determines the expressions of the person, okay? How I embed my hand differently in 3D space. Well, the intrinsic geometry determines the identity, okay? The same person will always have the same hand, no matter how he embeds it differently in 3D space. If a small ant would like to travel from that point to that point, it would have to travel through the same distance, even though I embed my hand differently in 3D space. Okay, so geometry is important. Geodesic distances are important. How can we compare two hands, two faces, treating them as metric spaces? So each face is now a metric space of its own. What would be the mathematical right way of comparing between these two metric spaces. Before we get into the Gumov house dot that I also put here on the board, let me just ask a trivial question that would allow you to follow me along this talk, and this is the following question. Say that you have only distances between 2 points, or 3 points, or 4 points. Can you take this distance structure and embed it into Euclidean space? Obviously, when I have 1 point, I can embed it into R0. Okay, 1 point is an R point, is a 1 point. If I have the distance between 2 points, delta ij, delta 1, 2, no problem. I can put them on a straight line, the first one and then the second one, and I can trivially embed 2 points with just the distance given between these 2 points into R1. 3 points. Okay, I have 3 points. I have distances between 3 points. I can take and put 2 points on a line, and then just measuring the distances from these 2 points, I can find the third point, and no problem, I can embed 3 points in R2. Could I carry on with this kind of trick? Well, those of you who are familiar with this question probably know the answer, but think about it for a while, okay? Those of you who don't, just think about this problem. Why? Because it's a nice problem. It would give us some, and it actually explains why this problem is. I mean, the answer is obviously no, and explaining why actually gives us the motivation of why we do all the stuff that we do. So if I want to compare the surface S to surface Q, what should I do? What Gromov told us is that in order to define a metric space over all metric spaces, what you could do is define through a Hausdorff distance, and I will show you in a moment why it's called a Hausdorff distance, optimizing for all target spaces in which these two surfaces or spaces lie. So let's first of all look at the explicit definition of the Gromov Hausdorff distance. What it says is the following: take each and every point in S and map it to a point in Q, and vice versa, and then measure the maximal distortion of the distances between these points. So if I map the point S to the point Q, Si to Qi, and Sj to Qj, what I would like to see is where the distance in S between these 2 points is as far away from the distance between their mappings in Q. Okay? If I find the maximal violation, then I've computed the Gromov Hausdorff distance. Okay, and this is obviously a bijectivity. For each point in S, there is a point in Q, and vice versa, and this is the Gromov Hausdorff distance. The problem is that if you write it like that, it looks like a difficult problem to solve. So we need something, we need a trick, we need to play with it a little bit, and this is what I will show you in this talk. And again, this talk is usually given as the last talk in my lecture. I prefer to give it as the first one, just that you know that you have, motivation, and since this is a short course. So, if I rewrite the Gromov-Hausdorff distance, as it was written here, in a different way, it appears that the Gromov-Hausdorff distance can be represented as follows. Find the Hausdorff distance of a mapping of S into some arbitrary space Z, and a mapping of Q into this arbitrary space Z. These mappings, these rho and sigma, are isometric, preserve the isometry. And in this space Z, find the Hausdorff distance using the isometry within Z between these two mappings. Okay? So, now the optimization is done through all possible target spaces Z. So, I didn't simplify the problem, okay? And still, it looks like a non-trivial problem to solve. In fact, under some scenarios, you can show that this is an NP-hard or NP-complete problem. But you can relax it, because usually this kind of difficult problems in computer science can be relaxed if you add constraints. So adding constraints simplify these relatively hard problems. And this is what we will do here. So first of all, let me review what other people have done. So what most of the scientific computing is doing is fixing the target space Z. Fixing it either to be Euclidean, to be spherical, to be some arbitrary, taking the eigen decomposition of the Laplace-Beltrami operator. We will focus on the Laplace-Beltrami operator in the next lectures in this course. And in this, by the way, in the space of eigenfunctions of the Laplace-Beltrami operator, you can start thinking about mapping shapes as Euclidean structures. Or a recent paper by Lippmann, Funkhauser, Debussy, and others, in which what they do is they take a surface and map it conformally either to a disk, if it has some open boundary, or to a sphere. And then they compare the shrinkage factor at each and every point, which means that what they do is they try to take one circle to another optimizing either for the Möbius transform or Möbius concatenated with the Earth moving distance, Monkantarovich transform. And the question is how to do it efficiently. And if you'd like, I could elaborate. In a sense, what all the methods above have been doing is compromising for the target space and thereby introducing embedding errors. While these methods are compromising for numerics, I mean, in this case, you have to truncate for the eigenfunctions at the point, so you basically go back to a finite dimensional space. And in this case, you pack a lot of important information into very tiny places, and therefore, you are losing a lot of information. Actually, I put this slide back because of a discussion that we had during lunch. Usually I don't show this whole history. And there are many others. I mean, if you go back to Berard, they were actually talking about the fact that you can do the Gomov-Hausdorff distance in the Laplace-Beltrami eigenfunction space. This was already done in 94. And many others have touched. I mean, there is the David Gu group who did a lot of papers along conformal mapping and some others. And obviously Memoli and Sapiro, who actually told us, Facundo Memoli in a very nice paper in 2005, and I actually indicated that the right way to compare between surfaces is the Gromov-Hausdorff distance. However, there is a problem of computing that. So how should we do that? So let's first of all go along the line of the simple stuff, I mean fixing the target space Z, and at the end I will show you that you can actually compute this distance with the right initial conditions quite effectively and quite nicely. So first of all, multi-dimensional scaling. Let's first take the distances that are given between two points and embed them into Euclidean space. The machinery to do that is called multi-dimensional scaling. So we get distances between points, say distances between all cities in Europe, and you would like to find the coordinates. What you do is you feed it into a multidimensional scaler, and what you get at the output after optimizing is coordinates in 3D space or 2D space or whatever Euclidean space that you would like to find your coordinates in. If you, for example, replace the norm here by the Frobenius norm, then what is written here is nothing but classical scaling, which is nothing but taking the eigendecomposition of the following form. I mean, what you do is you take the distances square, where the entry of each point here is delta ij square. You multiply it in both. I mean, if you think of how this matrix would look like, then it would have the coordinate of the first point and the coordinate of the second point. Minus the cross between them. Okay, this is pi, pj. One of them should be transposed. It depends how you define them. Okay, so this would be the entry of this distance function, and from that you would like, I mean, from these magnitudes you would like to get back the coordinates. In order to do that, what you need to do first is to kill these two matrices, and then by simple eigendecomposition you can extract back the coordinates. This is known as classical scaling. It optimizes for the Frobenius norm. Those of you who are familiar, for example, with PCA, it's basically the same thing. You treat the correlation between points as distances, okay? So you hit it with double centering matrix. This is nothing but the Laplace-Beltrami of a clique, of the clique of a graph, okay? So this J function is nothing but the identity minus a full matrix of ones. Okay? And this is nothing but the Laplacian. So this matrix would actually take the average from each and every row here and from each and every column here and basically eliminate these two the matrices that correspond to these two guys, and then by just SVD, what you get is P transpose P. It's actually, what you get is basically U lambda U transpose, something like that. Okay? This is, you need to, so this would be 2. Here. And there should be another lambda 1/2 here. So you can extract back the coordinates, so this would be the coordinates of your points. So multidimensional scaling in Frobenius norm is something which relates to the Laplace-Beltrami of the clique of the graph. Writing it in these terms is nothing but least square scaling, and it produces nice results, interesting results that we can work with. So in this case, we took one of my first students' face and we embedded them in R2. And what you can see is that by fixing the target space to be two-dimensional, we can do something. I mean, we can take a three-dimensional shape, embed it into a Euclidean domain, and things are preserved in many scales, I mean, in local and global scales. But it's not good enough to compare between faces, because if you think, for example, taking the hand and forcing it to be on the plane, then things would start fall one on top of the other. So there is some intrinsic difficulty in that. Then why don't we just go to higher dimensions? For example, taking R3 as the target space. So we take all geodesic distances in S, and we force them to be in R3 in this case. So think about the hand as if you blow air into the hand, like think about a glove, a rubber glove, and you force all hands to be inflated like that. Okay, you force this, you're Gulliver, and there is a line here that is connecting these two points, and you force this line to be as straight as possible. This is what multidimensional scaling will do to you. And we call it canonical form. Okay, in this new space, we call the new instance of the hand to be canonical form. So by optimizing the functional above, and you will see the functional again and again, because the measure again and again, because this is what we are optimizing for. We're optimizing, in this case, for the coordinates in R3. So if we do that for many objects like here, so if I just take this dog as set of points, and the person there as set of points, and compare one to the other, they would be much similar compared to the rest of the dogs here, okay? So just rotation and translation of the dog would probably lead it to be very similar to the person over there rather than the person to itself. However, translating the intrinsic geometry with the extrinsic one, like we do here, this canonization process takes a relatively complicated problem into a relatively simple one. So in this new space, all I need to do is just rotation and translation, and I can match between these objects. And just to describe pictorially what is going on, let me take the distance between each of these objects as an entry of a dissimilarity matrix and embed it in, for example, in R3. So I take the distance between these two points, these two surfaces, and these two surfaces as distances in some shape space, and the same goes for that. And if I embed it, for example, using again multidimensional scaling into R3, what we get is what you see over here. So each point here corresponds to a shape. This is before and after the canonization. And you can see that after the canonization, all the dogs are isolated as a group of their own. And all the giraffes here are embedded. I mean, the giraffes here are separate. But for example, human body and dogs are the red and the yellow structures here. So the canonization helps us in a sense. So fixing the target space to be Euclidean is problematic. Why? Because I introduce embedding error, and let me show you just what you can do with 4 points. I have 4 points now. Let me show you that it is impossible to embed them in R3, okay? And for that, or for in any finite dimensional Euclidean space with zero errors. So let's take, for example, the following constellation. You have 4 points on this graph. So these are 4 cities, A, B, C, and D, and the distance between each of these cities is 1. What you can see is that the distance between A, B, and C, between A and B is 1, between B and C and 1, and between A and C is 2, so they have to be along the same line, okay? So they are collinear points. But the same holds for A, B, and D, okay? So these are collinear, and these are collinear. It means that the point D and the point C should be the same point, which is violation of the fact that I claim that I can put it in Euclidean space. So somebody can claim that, look, this is a pathological example. You treat a graph which is a very non-smooth surface, and this is not what we encounter in usual life. So let's consider now the smoothest surface that one could think of. Let's consider a sphere. Okay? So let's think about a sphere. And I take 4 points. One, the North Pole. One on the equator, another one on the equator. Let's put these 2 points on the same great circle. And then another one on the equator, exactly at the center between these 2 points. So what would happen now? If I, again, call this point A, B, and C, and this point D, then A, B, and C are along a great line, a great circle. This is the equator. Okay, it's a great circle. So they should be along the same line. The same goes for A, D, and C. Okay, they are along the same line. So if I stretch this line, there is no way that the point D and the point B can be far away from one another. They should be the same point. So 4 points are difficult to embed in any Euclidean space. So when we in fact take a shape with effective Gaussian curvature, it is impossible to map it without distortions into Euclidean space. But still, we can see that embedding these shapes into Euclidean space, we can separate between these objects. And actually, it works also for faces. We can take faces, and taking care of the topology, I mean cropping out the mouth, we can embed these guys into here, the other guys into there. Each color here represents a different identity, each shape represents a different expression, and we can see that after the mapping, after the canonization, we can separate even between identical twins. I think that the purple blob and the brownish-yellowish blob relate to Alex and Michael. Okay, so we can separate between these objects. And this is classical scaling here. I mean, the functional over there is not what is written. It's actually the Frobenius norm. Yeah. Up to a point. And it would never, as you can see here, it would never converge. I mean, here the error would always be large. You cannot bound it. So yeah, it would go down initially, and then it would be fixed or converge to a finite error that never. Because there is an effective... If you think about the eigen decomposition here, okay, so think about... It's either you get complex values along the diagonal or negative values along the diagonal. It depends if you do SVD or some other stuff. But you're unable to kill these numbers. I mean, you can decompose only the positive part. The rest of it is something that you will have to live with. So the positive part would basically tell you which would be the largest Euclidean space in which you can embed your stuff and still gain something, after which you have to do something else. And there are things to do. So we take this remark from Gauss, the remarkable theorem that, and this is translation into faces of the remarkable theorem that faces cannot be embedded into Euclidean spaces. Why? Because they have effective Gaussian curvature. So before we go into more complicated way of analyzing the problem, let us zoom in back to faces. So faces are sort of spherical if you think about it. And multidimensional scaling is very good at embedding points into surfaces in which there is analytical solution for the distances between points. In Euclidean space, there is an analytic solution for the distance between points, and therefore we can either use factorization or use this kind of least square scaling. There is a procedure in MATLAB to do that, by the way. You can just use it out of the box. Apparently, for spheres, there is also a numerical solution, an analytical solution for the distances between points. So we can still try to use spheres in order to improve the situation a little bit. So if the spaces that we are working with should help us, let's choose them. For example, let's embed into spheres. When we take a face and embed it into a sphere, we can hope for a little bit better than Euclidean spaces. So this is Alex's face, for example, embedded into S2, and we also tried S3. There is still an issue of embedding into co-dimensionality zero. I mean, I take a two-dimensional manifold and I embed it into a two-dimensional manifold, so I need another number in order to do the matching. In this case, for example, the texture, you can think about Gaussian curvature, you can think about many, many other invariant measures. And there is also another free factor here, the radius of the sphere. I mean, this is not another free coefficient that we can play with. So if we take a space and embed it into S2, apparently for a sphere with a radius of about 10 centimeters, we get the best recognition rates. I mean, this is the best, yeah, we get the best recognition rates. So this is the best embedding error. I mean, this is the lowest embedding error that we can get. And for that, we get the best recognition rates. Why? Because we keep most of the information intact before distorting that. If you do the same trick for S3, so S3, we now start comparing the geometry itself. So here in a three-dimensional sphere, 7.5 centimeters were the point at which the embedding was done with the smallest error. And actually, for that point, we also got the best recognition rates. If, by the way, we inflate the sphere into infinity, then we get back the embedding into R3 that we have seen before. Okay? So embedding into sphere does something better, I mean, compensates somewhat better for these embedding errors, but we are not there yet. And the question is, can we do better? And the answer is yes, we can do better. I mean, why should we fear for embedding? So remember, what we are doing all the time is the functional that is seen over there. I mean, we take S and embed it into a space in which there is an analytical way of computing distances. Why are we afraid of spaces in which there is no analytical way of computing distances? We can compute the distances numerically. And this is what we shall be doing in the next slide. And this goes back to the Gromov-Hausdorff distance. Why? Because instead of taking S and Q and putting them into, I don't know, Euclidean spaces, and here doing rotation and translation of these two surfaces and thereby matching them, what we will do is try to tackle directly the Gromov-Hausdorff and map S into Q, treating U, Q as the target space. So our goal is actually comparing faces. Each face is unique by its own geometric structure. And the question is, how should we do it? And this is, again, the Mona Lisa face. And this is how Salvador Dali's concept was embedding his own face into the Mona Lisa, and this is what we'll try to do next. So what we would like to do is solve the following functional, the following measure. We would like to take the points in S, okay, S and S prime in S, and put them, find some phi function that takes the points in S and put them in Q such that the distortion is minimized. Okay? So we are trying to find the mapping from S to Q that would minimize the location of the points on Q the best way you can. So if we do that, let us first of all compare it to multidimensional scaling. So in multidimensional scaling, what we did is we took the points in S, placed them into Rn, by optimizing the coordinates, and got, by the way, the optimization for coordinates is done by something which is called Smarkov. It's basically a gradient descent process that is shown to be optimal in a sense. It's a non-convex problem, but nevertheless, you can work quite efficiently with that. With Irad Yavne, we introduced a multi-grid approach for that. Michael Bronstein and Alex Bronstein and Irad Yavne. And what we would like to do next is try to take the points on the surface S and embed them onto the surface Q the best way we can. So think about taking the points in the points on this hand, putting them on that hand, and letting the points find the best configuration so that the distances between each point to each point would be as close as its original source. Okay? So this is the similarity between these two objects. We call this functional GMDS, or generalized multidimensional scaling. Okay? And again, the main difference between the two problems is the fact that here we have analytical solution for the distances, here we have numerical ones. And here should come the next chapter. Writing the Gloom of House of Distance, by the way, can be done as follows, and this is something that was exposed to the shape matching arena by Memoli. It can be written as follows. You need to take all points from S, map them into Q. You need to take all points from Q, map them into S, and then take one point from S into Q, one point from Q into S. And if you're minimizing for these three coupled equations, three generalized multidimensional scaling formulations, then you solve the Gloom of House of Distance. This would guarantee bijectivity. Okay? So optimizing simultaneously for these three GMDS approaches, of course, here I change the L infinity by L2 by L infinity, but this is not a big issue from an optimization point of view. If you optimize for these three sets, then you basically optimize for the Gloom of House of Distance if you initiate it with the right initial conditions at the Bayesian of a fraction of the final solution. Yep. Okay. No, not really. Lipschitz embedding, for example, is nothing but taking the log of the R2. Oh, infinite dimensions you can do. There is a very nice Euclidean space in which you can embed and do the comparisons. This is the space spanned by the eigenfunctions of the Laplace Beltrami operator. It's an infinite dimensional Euclidean space. You have flips over there, by the way, which pose a different problem. This goes back to Rustamov, and I think that also Max Ostchanikov and the group from Stanford played with it a little bit. Yeah? Feel free. So any finite dimensional space, target space, would pose similar problems. But if we map these points into one surface into the other by optimizing this non-trivial yet solvable numerical problem, we can do magic. And this is the magic I'm talking about. Taking, for example, different instances of this face, first of all the same person and then a different person, and what we do here is we measure the distortion from each point, we integrate the distortion to the rest of the points. So you see that if this is a different person, here the red indicates relatively high distortion, then it immediately shows that this is indeed a different person. Well, if we take the same person, then we get an order of magnitude better embedding ability. So it can serve as a very delicate and very accurate face recognition or face matching integration over the relative distance. So you take the distance on the original surface and you compare it to the new distance. You integrate over all the errors, and this is the color that you see over here. And obviously, this is done after optimizing for the GMDS. In this case, since we take just a patch, then we take only one part of the Gloom of House of. We don't map all the points from one surface to the other, from one surface to the other, and the other to the first, but rather the first to the other. One part of that. So, just to summarize what I've been telling you until now, if we take a surface, we map it into Euclidean space, we call it multidimensional scaling. The target space has analytical solution, relatively easy to do, non-convex problem, but you can start with Frobenius norm, for which there is a global minimizer, and then refine it using this L2 norm, for example. However, if you now take the new trick and embed it into non-Euclidean spaces, then you need to, this is a little bit more elaborate numerically. Still, if you start with good initial condition, then you will converge, and hopefully if you converge to the global minimum, you compute the Gloom of House of Distance between the points, as well as you have the best possible matching between the two surfaces. So some applications. If, for example, we take this set of objects, and we sample them with 500 points using the canonical distance, these are the groups that we get after applying again multidimensional scaling. 50 points are enough to get much better separation using the GMDS. Okay? And again, what we do is we sample the surfaces cleverly, i.e. taking the furthest point strategy, which is too optimal in the sense of sampling the surface. We'll talk about it. Probably I'll also give a proof of that. Taking these surfaces, for example, and trying to map one surface to the other using the Gloom of Hausdorff, what we get is that, again, these surfaces have completely different triangulations. And what we are trying to do is take, I don't know, 60, 70 points over there and try to map them into the points on this surface. Once we have done it from one surface to the other, we can paint one surface and then let the texture follow the rest of the, using the mapping in order to texture the rest of the objects. And this is what you see over here. Okay, we just painted one surface and the painting goes to the rest, and we can now change the painting without any difficulty for just single object. We can explore symmetries. You know what, let me jump over the symmetries. We'll go back to it later. But just think about the fact that symmetries are clear when you're talking about the embedding space, okay? When there is a plane by which you can bisect the embedding space and reflect each point to each point, you can define symmetry. This is trivial. This is the classical way of defining symmetries. However, when the shape now is embedded differently in 3D space, it is less trivial to define symmetry. So symmetry has to be defined with respect to the metric space itself, okay? So I would like to match each point to each point here by the relative distance between the point to the rest of the points. If we explore the space of all possible self-embeddings, we can start exploring the self-symmetries of this object. And if we do that, we can find symmetries in a local, in an intrinsic sense. And in this case, what we did is we plot the distance, the distortion of each and every mapping. So we think about exploring all the space of possible embeddings and computing the distortion for each and every mapping like that. And then coloring each and every point according to the distortion. So red represents large distortion and blue represents small distortion. Obviously, we would like the minimal distortion that you see over here. These minimal distortions would be nothing but the identity, wearing the shirt left to right, wearing the trousers left to right, etc., etc. So this is the identity. This would be left to right. This would be front to back. And this would be front to back, left to right. Okay, and you can start exploring the space of all possible mappings by sampling it, letting it converge to the local minimum using GNDS, for example. And then if it's not the same, then sample it somewhere else, try to converge into the local minimum. And thereby, and then concatenate. I mean, if you have found these two, then obviously applying this function, this mapping on this mapping would give you that path mapping. Okay, so you can start exploring this shape of self-symmetries. We can use it for morphing, like taking the photometry from S into Q, or taking the photometry and the geometry, treating the distance between S and Q as a space of its own and interpolating in this, think about just considering it as a sublinear space and then just interpolating between S and Q gives you this smooth morphing between them. Obviously, when the things can fall apart when you have collisions. You can interpolate and extrapolate if you have the matching of each point in S to each point in Q. You can color one of the objects and then it would carry on to the rest of the expressions, etc., etc. Let me leave for a moment the partialities and because I really like to go into I would really like to go into invariants, so I will talk about the rest of the stuff later on. And now let me talk a little bit about more recent stuff that we have been doing, and this is invariant. So what would happen, for example, if I take the surface S and stretch it along one dimension so that volume is locally preserved? So the operator that operates on the coordinates here, so I have x, y, z prime equals to some matrix that operates on the original x, y, z coordinates. And let's, for simplicity, assume that the determinant of S, of A, is 1. Okay, this is the volume-preserving or equi-affine transformation. So for curves, it was well known that there is a very nice affine invariant arc length. It is nothing but the curvature 1/3 times the Euclidean arc length. I will probably talk about a little bit how to develop, how to compute this arc length. If you read a little bit further in affine differential geometry by Bouchin, you find out that it is also possible to define such a metric for surfaces. This metric can be extracted by the same geometrical reasoning. And this is again the Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. Why am I showing this picture? So in this picture, Lewis Carroll, who was a mathematician, takes an affine transformation of Alice. So when he describes in his book what happens to Alice after she drinks the forbidden potion, he talks about the fact that she sees how her head is departing from her toes. Okay, so she sees the deformation. Why? Because the transformation is affine. She is being stretched along one dimension. Walt Disney was not such a great mathematician, and in his interpretation of Alice in Wonderland, she scales up in all directions simultaneously. And therefore, he had to put something in the embedding space to show that what happens to her is indeed something that is, that indeed something happens to her. Why? Because if she would have looked at her toes, they would look the same. If everything scales up uniformly, nothing happens. So he put her in a house, and then the house blows up, and there is a bird at the top that flies away. So, first of all, we'll deal with the Lewis Carroll interpretation of the formation of Alice in Wonderland. And the question is, how can we define a metric that would be invariant to this kind of transformation? And again, this is going back to classical affine geometry and modifying it a little bit. We need to modify it because affine differential geometry is well defined for convex surfaces, okay? With effective Gaussian curvature. What should we do when we have when there are negative Gaussian curvatures? But there is not much, a little bit of treatment and you can deal with that. And then what we did, so I will give you the transformation, the metric afterward. The metric is nothing but, the elements of the metric, so this is Gij, is nothing but the determinant or the cross product between SU. So this is a UV parametrization surface. So we have X of U and V, Y of U and V, and Z of U and V. So it would be SU, SV, SIJ. So let's call this one G tilde. And like in the normalization, like the 1/3, like the third, taking the third root in the Euclidean space, Gij is equal to nothing but Gij tilde times G, times the determinant of G with the 1/4 power. Okay? So this is the affine metric. Now, we do a little bit of manipulation, and for the
What is
Sij? Is, if this is 1/1, if this is G1/1, then here you have GUU. If this is 1/2, this is the standard notation for definition of a metric. If it's 1/2, then it would be UV. If it's 2/2, it's VV. And by the way, you can compute it really easily from exactly as you do for the affine arc length. What you need to do is say the following. You start with, so if this is part of the surface, and this is SU, and this is SV, both of them belong to the tangent space, then what you need to do is, and assume that there is a curve that is going on here. What you need to do is find the parametrization of this curve such that the parallel pipe defined by these three vectors would always be equal to 1. Okay? This is our, this is the way that affine arc length was defined for a curve. So now you define a curve on a surface. When you do all the math, then what you get is this one, and then for reparametrization invariant, you get this factor. This part is easy. This part takes about 2 pages, but it's mainly technical. There is nothing sophisticated to it. The scaling part is easier to grasp, so I will, over there, I will be able to show you the proof very intuitively. So if we take, for example, the eigenfunctions of the Laplace-Beltrami operator computed with the regular norm. So what you see over there is the regular norm, okay? So this is how you compute the metric coefficients in the Euclidean case. So this is the shape, and this is the affine transformation of the shape, and this is after re-affinely normalizing the shape to its original shape. Okay, so if we compute the eigenfunctions here, these are the first eigenfunctions, and we color them on the surface, this is how they look. The black rings are the equal contours on these phi functions. If we use it with the affine one, then we see that we get completely different eigenfunctions. Okay, completely different. But if we use the new metric, magic happens. What we get is exactly, so this is the new metric, this is exactly what I wrote here. What we get is that the eigenfunctions correspond to one another. So we get exactly the same eigenfunctions. So we can start comparing between surfaces using this kind of metric. This is, for example, finding the Voronoi diagram. Do I need to... who doesn't know what a Voronoi diagram is? Don't be shy. Okay. Voronoi diagram is the following. If you have any space, any given domain, and you have points, then the diagram that would split the space into regions that would be as close as possible to this point and as close as possible to that point, and as close as possible to the other one, is called the Voronoi diagram. Okay, this is trivial to explain. It's not so trivial to. I mean, in the plane, it's very one of the most classical algorithms in computational geometry is the sweeping line algorithm for computing Voronoi diagram. This is the way, by the way. This is the way to compute the Lonoi triangulation, and it's a classical tool. On surfaces, it is less common to work with it, but still. It's very important, for example, in the city. If you split regions in the city between hospitals, for example, if somebody is injured in a specific region, then the Voronoi diagram that belongs to one hospital, everyone that would be hurt in this region would have to be evacuated to this specific hospital. So we have these hospitals on the horse. We have the purple hospital, the blue hospital, etc., etc. And we have the same points on the affine transformation of the horse. We see that if we take the affine transformation of the horse after computing the Voronoi diagram, it would not correspond to the affine Voronoi diagram of the original horse. Why? Because we used the wrong metric. If we correct it, if we use the right metric, the affine invariant metric, we see that. So now, in order to use the metric, we use second order derivative, so it's a little bit more noisy. I mean, these are not straight lines anymore. But still, we are able to show that these two Voronoi diagrams are very much alike, especially compared to the previous one. So we defined an affine invariant metric for surfaces, and we can compute geodesic distance on this horse, and we can compute them so that they are the closest possible to a point. I will show you how to compute distances, geodesic distances and others, with some new twist to that in the following lectures. Okay, so what do we do with that? The classical way of testing your algorithm, if you think that you can, that you have a nice algorithm, a good algorithm, the classical way to check it is by using one of the common benchmarks. And in this case, we use something which is called the Shape Google benchmark. So in this benchmark, we have many shapes. We have a shape of a person, a shape of a dog, a shape of a bird, a shape of a Superman, I don't know. And then these shapes go through various transformations, like affine transformation, isometries. This is supposed to be scaling, although it is not scaling. This is just morphological operation, so scaling should be taken with a grain of salt, as well as some many kinds of noises. I mean, just deleting triangles, adding some Gaussian noise, etc., etc. And each kind of noise is also applied in various magnitudes. And then what you do is you apply a sequence, an interesting sequence, which is called Shape Google. What you do is, first of all, you sample it with some feature points that are being determined more or less automatically. I will go into that, not now. So you compute kernels from which you compute heat kernel signatures heat kernel signatures. You vector quantize them. These features that you get, you quantize them, and you pack it as a histogram, which is called bag of features, and then you compare bag of features, and at the end of the day, you get a score that would tell you how good your metric is. Okay? So this is more or less standard, and feeding in the metric is something that we have done here. So when we apply the affine invariant metric, we got it for isometry. So what you see here is the magnitude, the level of deformation. And what you see here is isometries, and here you see affine transformations. So 1 to 5 would be more and more affine transformation. 1 to 5 here would be small isometries and large isometries, etc., etc. So you can see that obviously the right metric would operate well. So isometry and affine would obviously, the affine invariant would do quite good. And you can see that when there are topological changes, since we have to take second order derivative to compute the metric, then we lose a little bit more than the classical metric. Okay? So we pay a little bit by introducing second order derivative to the metric. Okay, going back to scale. Let us do it pedagogically. So how should we construct a scale invariant metric? Assume that we have a curve. Okay, and this curve is going through scaling of the whole space. So the whole space was either shrank or expanded. How should we design a scale invariant metric? Okay, so let us, for example, think about the tangent. What we know is that the tangent, the change of the angle of the tangent would always be the same as we scale the surface. Okay, so d theta, or theta here, if I denote this as theta, should remain the same as I change the scaling of the space. So, but we know that d theta over the Euclidean arc length is nothing but, thank you. Jose was taking my course, so he knows something. And he's, okay. So the change of the angle with respect to arc length is nothing but the 1 over the radius of the curvature. Okay, you can actually see that this is nothing but the 1 over the radius of the curvature. So in fact, we can define a scale invariant arc length by taking the Euclidean arc length and multiplying it by the curvature. Now, in surfaces, it is less trivial. Why? Because in surfaces, we have more than a single curvature. We have two principal curvatures that add up to either the mean curvature or the Gaussian curvature. So what should we do? Apparently, you can take the minimal in absolute value of the principal curvatures. It would be isometry invariant as well, but the Gaussian curvature would also do for that kind of scale invariance. So what we will do is take the regular metric. Okay, this is GIJ, which is nothing but the dot product between SI, this is capital S, okay, this is the surface, and SJ, where I stands for 1, 2, if it's U and V. And what we will do is, in order to make it scale invariant, so G scale invariant, let's call it G tilde, it's inverse S, would be nothing but the Gaussian curvature times SISJ. And we can prove that this is indeed a scale invariant quantity. So if we do that, we can start dealing with stretches like that, with Disney-like manipulation of Alice. So this is the scale invariant that I've just wrote for curves and for surfaces. And you can think about it. If you think about the oscillating circle at each and every point, then what you need to do is just blow up all these circles to be equal to 1, which is nothing but what is going on here. Okay, this is 1 over the radius, and this is saying that each and every circle should be equal to 1. Now, saying that, it doesn't mean that traveling along the curve is trivial. I mean, there is still the geometry of the curve determines how far away you go, but still, this is the way to construct this kind of environment. So going back to the same comparisons as before. So we take the Laplace-Beltrami operator and we decompose it into its eigenfunctions. And we see that if we take the eigenfunctions to be with respect to the Euclidean distance, to the Euclidean, to the classical metric, then here we took the armadillo shape and we scaled up this hand and we manipulated somewhat isotropically the head, and you see that everything is lost. I mean, the eigenfunctions do not correspond. However, if we now take the right metric, the scale invariant metric, this is the Gaussian curvature in absolute value, we get corresponding eigenfunctions. And if we get corresponding eigenfunctions, we can get corresponding eigenfeatures, and we can get corresponding... So these are eigenfeatures. Let me just give you a very brief intuition behind eigenfeatures between these heat kernel signatures. This is something, again, that was introduced... I don't remember if Michael and Alex were part of this group, but this is from the Stanford, from the Gibbs group. What they said is the following. Let's see, let's plot the rate of decay of heat that is originated at each and every point, okay? So we take all these points and we evaluate the rate of decay of heat that starts as a delta function. If you plot it and you normalize it with respect to the heat of the rest of the surface, then what you get is something like that for the blue point and something like that for the red point. Okay, so we get that for each and every point, these are the three points that you see over here, you get a different graph. Why? Because you use the classical metric. If you correct for the scale invariant metric, and in this case, the centra, we extended, I mean, we blew up the head, we scale up the leg, then you can see that these two signatures, these three signatures, are both informative, discriminative, as well as correspond to one another. Okay, and you can see that the symmetry, I mean, the fact that we took two hands makes the signatures actually very similar to one another. So this is the scale invariant metric and how we can use it. And this is again computing Voronoi diagram. In this case, this is the regular metric, GIJ equal SISJ. And this is the scale invariant metric, GIJ equal K times the regular metric. So you can see that with the new metric, the regions correspond to one another. I don't know if the colors correspond to one another because Jonathan Aflalo here, used some pseudo-random colors, but at least the parts correspond to one another. Okay. For example, we can start using this metric with the GMDS solver that I've shown you before. So if I'm using the regular metric with this armadillo, small head, large hand, smaller hand, then we get something which looks really, really bad. If we use it with the right metric, then we can start comparing. I mean, you can see that that this point that goes to the nose correspond to these two armadillos, even though this one was going through a quite effective transformation. So scaling is local. It doesn't have to be global. Now think about the following. We dealt with equi-affine transformations. We dealt with scale transformations. How can we put them both and actually deal with full affine transformations? There is a way. When there is a will, there is a way. In a nutshell, we can take the curvature that is computed from the affine invariant arc length and use it to generate a full affine invariant metric. Okay, so we can concatenate one on top of the other. There are some other tricks that you can play with here. Interesting tricks. For example, the regular metric is SISJ. The affine metric is nothing but a scalar that multiplies the equi-affine at each and every point. we can play with a knob that switches between these two metric spaces, okay? We can interpolate, we can take the eigenfunctions with respect to one metric, the eigenfunctions with respect of a different metric, and now do some basis pursuit. Represent each and every part of the object with different metric. We have started playing with that, and there are some very interesting results. I mean, it depends. If you'd like to capture texture, then this guy should be the dominant one. If you'd like to capture flat things, then the regular one should be the one to dominate the representation of the shape. And it's a very nice game to play. I mean, we are just starting to sense it. This is something from the last year or so, and this is why I'm so excited and spend so much time on it. So let me wrap everything and then leave some room for questions. And I promise you that the next lectures would be less formal from the point of view of presentation introducing things in a more axiomatic manner. I mean, I will put the assumptions and then we'll construct the solutions. So what I've shown you is that if I would like to compare two metric spaces, for example, faces, then the first way to think of, by simplifying the problem, by fixing the target space, is first of all putting the target space as R2. It was good mainly for texture mapping. I mean, if we take a surface and we map the points, the distances on the surface to the plane, and then we take another surface and map crop out the mouth so that we get the same topological surfaces, and then do the matching, then it's good mainly for very trivial applications like texture mapping, in which we would like the target space to be Euclidean space. Why? Because we have codimensionality zero, and we cannot do much with codimensionality zero. The texture has to play some game here, or Gaussian curvature, and it's not a healthy way of treating surfaces. Next, we took codimensionality higher than zero. I mean, in this case, for example, we embed these faces into R3. So we take one face, embed it, replace the intrinsic geometry with extrinsic one. We do it for the second surface, and then just using ICP, for example, iterative closest points, classical way of shifting and rotating in 3D space in order to match the surfaces. And we got very nice recognition rates for faces, but still, this is not Gromov-Hausdorff per se. I will skip the fact that we also use it for surfaces, for spheres, and go directly to GMDS, in which we took one surface and tried to embed it into a different one by giving a numerical rule by which the points try to navigate into places such that the distances on the new surface would be as close as possible to the distance on the original surface. Okay, and this one was the GMDS. If you pack three of them together, what you get is the Gromov-Hausdorff distance. And at the end of the day, so these were the multidimensional scaling, and that was the GMDS, mapping one surface to the other, and eventually we embed it into a book, and this is the book that we will not focus on this short course. I mean, this talk relates to the book by Michael, Alex, and myself, and you can find questions and stuff over there. What shall we do in the next lecture? In the next lectures, I will talk. I will talk not a little bit, but more than a bit, about curves, curve evolution, and I'm sure that you have heard before, probably from Salim and from Laurent Cohen and others, but I will try to, I mean, hearing more of the same is tedious, but I will try to do it a little bit different. I will relate, for example, level sets, which is a way of solving for curve evolution to optical flow problem. And I will show you that essentially these two problems are the same. Actually, the same formulation leads from one to the other. This is a synthesis problem and this is an analysis problem. I mean, here the level sets are given and what you are trying to do is extract the velocity. Here the velocity is given and what you are trying to do is extract the level sets. So, and compute the level sets. So I will show the duality between the two. I will talk about a little bit about fast marching method, and I know that you heard about it from Laurent, and the duality to active contours. In that domain, I will show you that, for example, the Kenny edge detector, or the Harlech edge detector, or the Marin-Hilbert edge detector, can be extracted from a very nice geometric functional. And I will elaborate a little bit about this geometric functional. It encapsulates a very nice theory and as well as practice from curve evolution and calculus of variations and everything. It's a really nice talk that I would like to give here. And at the end of the day, I will try to pack everything together. So this is more or less relates to two chapters. And at the end of the day, I will try to wrap everything together into something that would give some sense and view the all this stuff from the point of view of the Laplace Beltrami operator. So it appears that some of the things that I was talking about here today, although I didn't mention them, like diffusion geometry and Beltrami framework for image processing, as well as active contours, fast marching, level sets, and optical flow, are all somehow related to this operator that I have written here. And I will try to, after I introduce these two topics, I will try to tailor everything through this operator. And this would give a full picture of the whole stuff. I'll be happy to answer questions. I mean, no one after. No.